The first case for argument this morning is Gates v. Baker. Mr. Dockerman.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Michael Dockerman, and with Libby Wassef and Teresa Sullivan, I represent the Baker parties, one of two groups of judgment creditors against the Republic of Syria. Both of the groups of parties that you see before you today are representative of victims of terror. Under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, we compete to try to collect assets of the Republic of Syria. And the issue presented today is the appropriate interpretation of Section 1610C of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. It's an issue, as far as we can tell, of first impression. There has been a lot of work under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and much of what has been written about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, almost exclusively at the district court level, has focused on the clause having to do with the period of time that must elapse before attachment can begin. But the issue presented today is different. The issue presented today has to do with the beginning of that clause. No attachment or execution referred to in subsections A and B of this section shall be permitted until the court has ordered such attachment and execution after the period of time, a reasonable period of time, has elapsed. The meaning of that particular clause is covered both in the Senate and in the House reports. The language is identical, and if I may look at page 29 of the Senate report, it talks about the fact that Section 1610C prohibits attachment or execution unless the court has issued an order for such attachment and execution. Why? The Senate report goes on. In some jurisdictions in the United States, and Illinois is one of them, attachment and execution to satisfy a judgment may be had simply by applying to a clerk or to a local sheriff. This would not afford sufficient protection to a foreign state. This subsection contemplates that the courts will exercise their discretion in permitting execution. As I said, the House report is identical. The order upon which the Gates parties rely is an order which they received in the District of Columbia, and it does not talk about attachment or execution anywhere. An attachment or execution has to do with something. In this instance, an account. And it was an account that was created by AT&T for money which it owed to the Syriatel, or the Syrian National Telephone Company. The Gates order, which is at page A18 of the record, says that the court, this is the district court order in the District of Columbia, the court finds that a reasonable period of time has elapsed from the entry of final judgment and notice to Syria thereof to the date of the entry of this order for attachment and execution to proceed. It does not say where, it does not say how, and it does not say when. And
Mr. Dockerman, can I ask you a preliminary question here, which is whether any order under 1610C is necessary, given that it looks to me as if the Gates plaintiffs, and you all for that matter, could proceed under 1610G, which does not seem to require such prior permission to protect the interests of the state that has sponsored the terrorism.
As you may know, Judge Hamilton, there is very little law so far under 1610G.
I have text.
Yeah, that's about it. That's about it.
So,
there is a description of how it might work in one of the decisions by Judge Lamberth, but that decision does not say Section 1610C has now been abrogated.
I didn't ask whether it's been abrogated. The question is whether under the text of the statute the Gates plaintiffs are proceeding under 1610G.
No.
Why not?
Because here, although we're talking about an account that has been seized and frozen, and we all learned about that account because we all were told by OFAC at the same time where the assets were, and other than mentioning AT&T, I think I'm prohibited by a protective order from getting into more detail. We do not know how long that will be frozen. And so in order to be able to sometimes the money is released. What the bank does or what the beneficiary of the account does is applies for an OFAC license. That creates a tension between the attachment, which is created by state statute, and the freeze order, which has now been relieved under a license by OFAC. So in our reading of 1610G, you cannot proceed directly against those assets.
All right. I understood the last thing you told me, but I don't understand how that conclusion follows.
In our view, Your Honor, if the Congress had wanted to make Section 1610G freestanding, it could have said so. One of the problems, and this is an awkward argument for a victim of terror to make,
no,
because
doubt.
There are so many roadblocks. Nevertheless, we feel we have complied because we must comply with all of those roadblocks, which is what distinguishes us from the Gateses. Now, the court raises whether Section 1610G intended to eliminate that roadblock, but there's nothing in the legislative
history. For terrorism cases.
For terrorism cases in which there is a frozen account, effectively, Your Honor. Because when you Section 1610G does not say ignore 1610A or 1610B. It says under 1610G, we're trying to make things easier. And, of course, that ease is something which we and others similarly situated would appreciate. But if you actually look at the specific language of 1610G, it says, in general, subject to paragraph 3, the property of a foreign state against which a judgment is entered under 1605A, and this judgment is under 1605A, and the property of an agency, including property, held directly or indirectly in a separate juridical entity, is subject to attachment and aid of execution, and execution upon that judgment as provided in this section, regardless of, and then there are subsections. It does not say that we don't have to go to a court and let a court make a determination as to whether it's appropriate for us to proceed in the first instance. To do so would eliminate that language in 1610C, which says a court, not a clerk, looks at this.
Right, but 1610C obviously applies very broadly to perfectly normal commercial disputes.
Right.
And Congress has repeatedly here told the courts, in essence, that they have construed too narrowly the relief that Congress has intended to provide to victims of state-sponsored terrorism. And so just how tender should our concern be for Syria and its instrumentalities as both you and the Gates plaintiffs try to collect these assets?
The same rule, Your Honor, would apply not just to Syria, to whom I have no tenderness, and I'm sure neither of the groups of parties before you have any tenderness, but it also applies, for example, to other nations which are asserting some kind of interest, and it's not as clear that the nation itself, but maybe somebody within that nation, is a state-designated sponsor of terrorism.
But 1610G is only state-sponsored terrorism that has been taken to judgment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the court's interpretation, and it would be an interpretation of first impression, is that 1610G relieves those of us in the position of my clients from having to comply from 1610C, that would be good news, quite frankly, for everybody but the Bakers in this case, but there will be other assets.
Mm-hmm.
There is some guidance, however, from two decisions from circuit courts, which we followed. And it's not really on 1610C specifically. One of those courts is this court. In Rubin versus the Islamic Republic of Iran, the court considered the extent of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the role that 1610C plays in that regard under Section 1609 of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, the preceding section. It had to do with so-called attachment immunity. Here we were talking about collections at the Oriental Institute and at the Field Museum, which the plaintiffs there sought to attach. And the court said at the time, and if I might quote, the court reversing, finding that the text, structure, and history of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act requires the plaintiff to identify the specific property he seeks to attach. The court cannot compel a foreign state to submit to general discovery about all its assets in the United States. The presumption of immunity also requires the court to determine, sua sponte if necessary, whether an exception to immunity applies. The court must make this determination regardless of whether the foreign state appears. That's at 637 F3rd at 785 and 786 of this court's opinion. Applying that same rationale to the question, Judge Hamilton, that you have put, it still requires a court to make a determination because the balance struck by the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and although some congressmen have said the courts are being too chary, that's not what the statutes they have passed have yet done, says that a court must decide first whether you can attach, because if not, you would be hailing foreign states into the courts of the United States and subjecting them to what was at issue in the Rubin case, general discovery. What happens here, once the judgment is registered in the Northern District of Illinois, as we apply in this instance to Judge Guzman, and ask him, may we proceed against assets that we think we have found, and under seal we told him, because OFAC made us get that information under seal, what those assets were. That avoids the general attachment proceedings and the general response to discovery, which frankly, Your Honor, your suggested interpretation of Section 1610G could lead to have happening, which is why we read 1610G in terms of 1610C. Now, there's one other court which has approved the process that we follow, and that's the Second Circuit. In the Karahabotis case, which is cited in our briefs, involving an international arbitration in Switzerland between some claimants and an Indonesian national oil company, the international arbitration proceeded to award. The defendant was called Petamina. The oil company owned and operated by the state of Indonesia. The claimant there, KBC, sought enforcement in the Southern District of Texas, and the district court in Texas entered judgment on the arbitral award. And I want to make sure I get this right. KBC then filed a 1610C motion seeking to register its judgment in Delaware, New York, and California, specifically saying those are the assets I want to go after. And the district court allowed it to seek enforcement in those courts. It then went to the Southern District of New York, registered its judgment in the Southern District of New York, and sought an order under 1610C saying there are seven accounts on which we want to execute in the Southern District of New York. And that's exactly what the court in the Southern District of New York allowed it to do. That procedure is approved by the court in Karahabotis. So the only thing that to which we can look at the appellate level in the federal system that says how do you do it is what we had from the Second Circuit. Otherwise, there are differences at the district court level, none of which are binding. Now, the trial court, actually Judge Lindberg first before the case went to Judge Kendall, said, we want to be practical. And he looked to language in other cases at the district court level, saying, we want to be practical. You need to be practical in interpreting the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Unfortunately for us, all of us who are trying to collect against the sponsors of terror, all of that relief language comes in cases under 1608, the notice provision. It says we want to be practical about notice. There is no case at the appellate or at the trial court level which says you need to step back from the specific provisions of the statute. What we did here is what the statute said we had to do. And the Gates intentionally elected not to do that.
You say the statute required you to do this. I look at 1610C, and I don't see language that requires more than one order, nor do I see any particularly compelling reason why more than one should be needed.
Had we, at the time that we applied under Section 1610C in the D.C. Circuit, in the D.C. District Court, and I'm sure the same would have been true for the Gateses, known from OFAC where assets were, and had we gone to the district court in the District of Columbia and said, we now know that there is an account, and that account is in the Northern District of Illinois, allow us to proceed to attach there. And by the way, are you familiar with the attachment proceedings there? Because you can do it by clerk rather than go to a court. We would have done so, Your Honor, but we did not know at the time. And there's another issue under Illinois law, which is the judgment which we entered becomes a new judgment. There's no 1610C order on that new judgment under 1402. And so bringing just that judgment here and trying to attach under it may not comply with 69A and what it requires for us to adhere to the Illinois procedure. That's why, Your Honor, although it is Byzantine, it is, in our view, what the statute requires. Some judge has to tell us, you can go after these accounts. And in the absence of that, we would have violated 1610C. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, unless the court has other questions now.
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Dockerman. Mr. Salter?
Good morning. May it please the court, on behalf of Sarah and Patty Hensley and Francis Gates and Jan Smith, may it please the court, this is a simpler case than I think the interveners. I'm going to refer to them as the interveners because that's how the posture of this case went. This is a simpler case than I think is being portrayed by the interveners. It's a simple case because it's an issue of priority between two judgment creditors that is controlled by the state law, which is made simple, about how we resolve competing claims between judgment creditors. There's a couple things I'd like to make to kind of clear the decks on. First, and different from cases like Rubin from this circuit, there are really kind of two types of immunity that have been raised and have been stumbling blocks, especially pre the 2008 amendments that Congress enacted for specifically for the benefit of clients like mine and the interveners. There are two types of sovereign immunity, and it's kind of confusing because they're not coextensive. But I want to make it absolutely clear to this court that it breaks into jurisdictional immunity, which speaks to whether or not you can even be in court under Article 3, and execution immunity, which looks at the particular assets. There is no issue disputed by the parties in this case that jurisdictional immunity does not apply. 1605 capital A got both parties past that, beyond any question. There is no issue of execution immunity, like there was in Rubin with those antiquities that were on loan from the Iranian government to the Chicago museums, because these are blocked and frozen accounts. And pursuant to the laws that were passed specifically for our benefit, and Judge Hamilton, you are exactly right. It's a frozen account. Execution immunity, we're clear, we're past that. These have been specifically given a preference for clients like mine to encourage and facilitate enforcement of these judgments because in the past it had been stymied and there had been too many stumbling blocks. So with that all said, what's really going on here is the interveners are asking for, they think they're entitled to more protection than Syria, the judgment creditor, would be entitled to complain of in this court. Why do I say that? Well, it's because Syria, under various case laws cited in our brief, could never reasonably be heard to complain of due process or a lack of notice under these facts, either in the underlying proceedings, which were, there was great consideration given to them in the underlying proceedings in the D.C. courts, the federal courts there. There was also extensive consideration given by Judge Lindbergh to notice and to due process of Syria and its agencies and instrumentalities, Syrian Telecom being the one we're at issue here today. If there be any doubt that Syria had actual knowledge, which is key under some opinions that have been, one from the Ninth Circuit called Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B, where the Ninth Circuit said it matters to the, when we're looking at the notice and whether or not there was compliance with the notice provisions under 1608, which are incorporated by reference explicitly in 1610C, and we contend should be read in pari materia with it. But in looking at this, this is not something where, oh, there's a technical defect and there's no harm, but we don't care. You're out of court. That's not what happened in the Ninth Circuit. It's not what happened in the Baker's own case, the case law they created at the D.C. Circuit, where they said, in fact, we have a 1610C order because even after the actual notice and they came in and Syria actually fought us on appeal in the D.C. Circuit, even after our 2008 judgment, we get an affirmance from the D.C. Circuit in 2011. We took the extra step out of an abundance of caution of getting a 1610C order despite their abundant and vigorous contest in the appellate proceedings. And even after that, and I'd like, for the record, to show how extensive the notice has been to Syria, even once the proceedings began here regarding the enforcement proceedings, what pot of money we were going after, what we were going to get to it, and how it was going to work. Look, I would point to the court to page A11, Appendix 11, which is the order from which we're appealing regarding this set of funds. And in paragraph 36, you will see a string cite of docket entries. What those prove are what Judge Lindbergh ordered us very early in the case. He said, y'all serve these people at their last known address. Anybody you can serve, serve. And we did. You will see on our certificates of service, we served the Foreign Ministry of Syria at its address in Damascus. At the last known address, we served Mr. Ramsey Clark, Esquire, who was the lawyer who appeared in the D.C. Circuit for Syria on all of this stuff. And then we served Syrian Telecom and its known mail address in Damascus. There is no reasonable complaint that Syria could hold before this court to say they didn't know, that they were not provided ample opportunity between 2008 and these proceedings to say that they could have paid this judgment and avoided being subjected to collection proceedings. And that's the real purpose. If you look at the language of 1610C, that's the purpose that animates this. It is not a, well, you've got to educate Syria when you go to Illinois to tell them all about the peculiarities of state of Illinois collection procedures. That's not what 1610C says. And my brother at the bar cut short the part in his reading of the statute. Read it all the way to the end because it references the reasonable time is measured from the judgment and the service of that pursuant to the to whatever service is required under 1608E. This is not, and if you go to 1608E and you read them together, what that shows is this is a one-time order. Judge Hamilton, it is. You're correct. I think you're seeing that. And the reason we know that is if you read these two together, what you see is 1608E requires the serving of the default judgment if it's a default, and nothing more. And I would respectfully submit, I don't mean to give the members of Congress too much credit, but I would suggest that had they intended to require a successive, onerous, I would submit, bunch of serving all of your papers, especially through the 1608 requirements, which are really super service, which are very, very onerous and very rigorous, if they were going to require the repeated going to federal judges two and three and four times simply to say there's been a reasonable time passed, I would suggest to you that Congress would have said so.
Mr. Salter, could you comment on whether 1610C applies at all?
I don't think it does. Now, to be quite fair with you, I don't think we raised this a great deal in before the court rendered its decision on priority on March 7, 2012. I don't think we needed to. They've argued we waived this. I believe it's our duty as appellees to point to any alternative reasoning that would support an affirmance, and I think we're allowed to as appellees under the harmless error statute, and to show that the appellants can't carry the burden of showing harmful error. Look at Heiser, H-E-I-S-E-R. Judge Lamberth dealt with this, and what he pointed to is he said, listen, we come back to this in 2008. All of the legislative history that they're traveling under, the interveners, I would submit, if you look at the citations of the brief, it's all 1976 when FSIA was first passed. But you cannot ignore what animated the 2008 amendments to liberalize, with subsection G in particular, the enforcement. And what Judge Lindbergh, Judge Royce Lamberth, who is kind of the dean of this area of the law, said is he used the word the explicit exclusion when they went back in 2008 of subsection G from subsection C, and the explicit inclusion in C of subsections A and B tells us that Congress did not intend to make enforcement under subsection G subject to subsection C. Now, that's an alternative basis to affirm this, but it's certainly not the only one. And he also pointed out that this interpretation is entirely in keeping with the legislative intent behind the 2008 amendments. And I would suggest that that's very persuasive precedent. Let me make one point before I start encroaching on me having to sit down. Before we get to the merits of the statutory interpretation question, which is not explicit, there is no, and Rule 69A, let me say this, state law governs except to the extent a federal statute controls. Not Levin, some unreported decision from the Southern District of New York, I would submit. That law would not be controlling and would not trump the state law's priority rules of first in time, first in right. We make it clear so there's no confusion. Levin doesn't get you there. And there is no explicit and clear requirement to get a successive, redundant, I would submit, order from the second or third or the fourth judge in a new district every time you go, once you have already satisfied. And that, under Rule 69A, really kind of answers the question. But before we even get there, let me point the court to the problems we submit that infect the relief, the request for appellate relief here, that are caused by the way the record was handled or perhaps mishandled. There is the underlying assumption beyond this request for appellate relief by the interveners is the idea that they are a lien holder and that they perfected a lien and that that lien would attach to the particular assets at issue here of this agency or instrumentality. I would submit to you that there is no proof in the record of any of those things. And if there's no proof in the record, we would submit to you that you can't afford relief here that they're asking for. I want to call attention to the motion that we filed about the appendix and the order that was entered by this circuit court in October. And what y'all said is we brought to the court's attention the fact that from A64 in the appendix all the way to the end, none of those documents that they're relying upon in some cases, none of that was in the record before the district court. And in fact, some of it occurred after Judge Lindbergh had issued his priority ruling on March 7, 2012. Why is that important? It's important. It matters very much because if they can't show that they had a lien that was co-ate, specific to an agency like an instrumentality like Syrian Telecom, they can't point to that in the record. They can't show harmful error, and it's their burden to do so. The court said you denied that motion in October, but what you said is, appellees, you addressed that in your brief. We have. And what you did is, I thought was very fair and fair-minded. You said to the appellants, to the interveners, true this up. We're going to give you an opportunity to cure. File a motion under Rule 10 to supplement if you can, but they haven't. Those problems, before you even get to these issues, which are very interesting, under 1610C as a statutory interpretation, but I don't think it's close, but you don't get there. And when we challenge them in our brief of appellee to say, you can't show us in the record where your lien is. You can't show service of your lien, which is where your lien gets created, if a citation or if it's a garnishment. You have to serve the judgment debtor. We served the judgment debtor when we did it, and that's in the record. But they can't show record proof of that. And that is, I think, a mistake that is hard to get past under the rules that are accepted for this court. And I'd also point out that judicial notice, which I think they have posited as a workaround in their reply brief, doesn't get you there.
Mr. Salter, is it fair in any way to characterize your argument, not on the lien issue, but on the interpretation issue, that your view is that G, 1610G, silently amends A and C?
I don't think it silently amends so much as it creates a new mechanism that is free and clear of the restrictions of A and B. And why do I say that? Because if you look at A and B, and this is a point I think Judge Hamilton alluded to, A and B are actually kind of restrictive. There are some things you have to prove for enforcement under A and B that are really applied generally to all FSIA litigants. It has to be commercial property in some cases. It has to be property that's related to your claim in order to enforce. There are some other restrictions in there that, and I would submit that Caritas, that other case, that I forget that name, but Bodus or whatever, that is a pre-2008 amendment case. And I think those are the kind of issues that worry about the execution immunity issues. We're not in that league. But I do think that subsection G is a standalone, and had they intended to subject it to C, especially given how explicitly narrow C is in referencing enforcement specific under A and B, I think that would have said so. And that's what Judge Lambert said. Now listen, Your Honor, in all candor, the Southern District of New York judge in Levin did disagree with this point, and we pointed that out of fairness. But if you look, compare the two decisions and the reasoning and try to pick which one is more persuasive, Levin relies a lot on legislative history, really to the detriment of the plain language. Y'all have criticized that as a method of statutory interpretation before. I think that if you read the statute together, it's very clear. Let me point out a couple of decisions where you may ask, why didn't you do this out of abundance of caution, get a second redundant 1610C order? We're not the only ones who have said, we don't need to do that. We just read the statute and thought we didn't need to do that. Look at the Bennett case, the Northern District of California, relatively recent case, I think it's 2010 or 11. Also the Peterson case out of the Ninth Circuit. If you will find in both of those instances, the plaintiffs who are victims of terrorism like us, both courts, Ninth Circuit and the Northern District of California, pointed out, well, you got a 1610C order from the D.C. District Court. Next issue. It's explicit in there. They didn't make a big deal out of it. It wasn't examined ad nauseum, but it's clear that the assumption was you read the statute. There's no other requirement once you've gotten there. And Judge Lindbergh was right. This is just common sense. This is simple.
If I could, Mr. Salter, ask you one quick question more that I hope Mr. Dockerman might also address. Yes, I assume that this is a pretty small community of victims of state-sponsored terrorism who have been able to pursue claims in court, mm-hmm. and an even smaller community of lawyers like you all who are expert in this area.
Well,
and
I'm obsessed at this
I'll
point.
Say that for both of you. But that suggests to me that we need to be especially cautious, because we have to assume that both of you and your clients and your colleagues are all going to be paying extremely close attention and will even hints that we whisper are going to be heard as shouts in this community of lawyers and clients. I'm not sure that's a question, but I invite your comment.
I would say that you're right. You have, if you write the decision the way they're asking you to write it, let me posit what that could do in terms of setting up the chaos between competing judgment creditors. What you've got is a state party rule that's very clear by necessity. First in time is first in right. No to question, we were first. What they want you to do is to imply into 1610C, make it a super priority statute. And I would submit to you that that's not consonant with the plain language of the statute. It's not consonant, especially with the recent legislative history of it. But also think about what happens if we now arrogate this implied requirement, this set successive determinations. Are people going to now say, well, yeah, you were first in time with a lien under state law, but we got our 1610C order first in that district? And I think that creates a kind of irreconcilable conflict that district court judges would and litigants would have a terrible time trying to resolve, and it would create a mess, with all due respect. I am out of my time.
So let me just ask one last question, unless my colleagues have another. If we place this reliance, as you would have us, on G, what impact would that have on the reasonable time question that's in the statute under C?
Well, I think that I think that's a fair concern. That's the one criticism you would have of Hauser. However, in terms of providing notice to you really do have to look at the fact that there are different. Well, I think you have to just look at whether you believe the plain language trumps fairness. In that, I mean, if you have a fairness objection, that you have to look at whether plain language trumps that, and you have to also consider the fact that under G, you are enforcing it as against a different entity. But I do think you're. I mean, I think that you've got a fair concern. There is a difference of opinion on Levin and as expressed by Judge Lamberth and Hauser. I would point out, though, that is not a harm that occurred here to Syria in this case, and I think it's unreasonable, and that's why you point out the.
I think that observation seems accurate to me, but just reflecting on the dialogue you had with my brother Hamilton. That's just another concern.
Yeah. I would say that could be a concern, but in this case, the notice is so overwhelming at every level, and it's so documented that we're strict about it,
Sometimes we have to draft the opinion for the next case, too.
And that's why we wanted to point out the problems with the record that really pretermit.
No, I appreciate that response also.
If there's no further questions, we'll rest on our briefs and take your seat.
Apparently not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Soller. Mr. Dockerman.
Let me first accept Judge Hamilton's invitation to address an issue, and then if I may turn to the question which you asked. Do not speak with a whisper or a murmur, if I may ask this court. Speak clearly, because this is an area where there is a small fraternity of people who have been victims of terror. No, there's a large community of people who have been victims of terror. There's a small community who have had the fortitude to stay with decades of litigation in order to try to bring cases to judgment, find assets on which there can be execution, and I might add also comply with the procedural hurdles of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. It's very difficult. So to the extent that this court does give guidance on 1610C and 1610G, please do so clearly. We do suggest to you this is a case...
Larry, you're asking an enormous amount from this court to speak clearly.
Judge Bauer, I've watched this court's opinions for 36 years. They are often clear. Not always to me. The issue that we have to address here in 1610C and G is to give full interpretation, unfortunately, to all of the language of 1610C. There are four clauses here, and we keep focusing on different parts, and we have to read the whole thing. No attachment or execution referred to in A and B of this section shall be permitted. That's the first clause. Until this court has ordered such attachment and execution. That's the second clause. That's the clause which we submit needs clarification. The third is, after having determined that a reasonable period of time has elapsed following the entry of judgment, that's the third clause. And then there's a fourth clause, and the giving of notice required under Section 1608E of this chapter. The only relief any court has ever given any of us in trying to attach assets under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is on that fourth clause. And to the extent that this court is prepared, part of me says, I hope you are prepared, but for these clients, I have to say, I hope you're not prepared, to read 1610G silently to amend A, B, and C. I can only suggest to you that you look at Judge Lamberth's opinion, because he's the one who's lived with this, and as the court has read his opinions, he has 14 years of opinions in this case, in these cases against Iran. And in his case, 659 F sub 2nd 31, In Re Islamic Republic of Iran Terrorism Litigation, which is in the briefs, and which is the most comprehensive history of the FSIA, he says at page 123, Section 1610G is unlikely to be the cure-all that some plaintiffs perceive it to be. As with past measures intended to help victims execute judgments, a myriad of legal issues still await the befuddled plaintiffs at every turn. And there just isn't anything to say that it is that cure-all, Judge Hamilton. And if I may just address the issue of the record briefly, Your Honor, I would invite the court to look at A46, which is the memorandum opinion written by Judge Kendall, on which she relies on the record in four cases, and it is captioned in four cases. That is 11C8715, that's the Gates claim, 11C8913, that's the Baker's claim, and then two interpleaders, one brought by AT&T and one brought by J.P. Morgan Chase, because all of these cases were different ways of approaching the different things. The court clearly looked at all of these. We tried to bring crisply to this court, and Judge Lindbergh certified to this court, the issue of whether we had done what we needed to do. And this court said, don't come now. Wait until the interpleaders, not the case which we had appealed, but the interpleaders have been decided, because there is a combined record here. And that's exactly why the opinion, which explains what was done, is the opinion in all those cases. And at page A62 of the record, Judge Kendall says, because the relative rights of the Baker plaintiffs and the Gates plaintiffs to the EFTs and the deposit account, and here we're talking about the deposit account, have been determined by this court's prior orders of March 7, 2012, and September 28, 2012, and March 28, 2013. Any concerns in the interpleader related to the Baker plaintiffs have been addressed on the merits in the prior opinions. Those claims are dismissed. It's all together.
I'm going to have to ask you to have a concluding remark.
I'm all done, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate it.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but...
I just wanted to answer that last question.
If you would, though, on that reasonable time, you said you were going to make a comment with regard to the inquiry I made of Mr. Salter.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for giving me the time to do so. There is a comment in a couple of opinions out of the Second Circuit, and it is dicta, but it suggests... And it's not in a case that we cited to you, because it's not in a case that deals specifically with these issues. But it says the only value of a 1610C order on reasonable time in the court where it's given before you're talking about an attachment is that it's probably res judicata, or at least an estoppel argument, on the issue of whether time has passed, but not on the issue of attachment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all counsel. And the case is taken under advisement.